on a rainy Saturday afternoon to Woods and Water, South Carolina. But you love living in South Carolina. You can have all three seasons within 24 hours. You have the deep of winter, spring day, and a fall day all on the weekend. And for those of you sitting out on Woodruff Road going Christmas shopping, remember, be nice to each other. I was out there Thursday, and I don't think I'm going to go back on Woodruff Road until the middle of January. And I wasn't even out there shopping. So anyway, but you're listening to 94.5 WGTK, The Answer in Greenville, South Carolina. Always nice to have in-studio guests. I was expecting one today. I got three, and I welcome them all. But Brad Bramlett's here from the South Carolina Forestry Commission. Brad, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Roger, for having me.
And we've got his daughter, Savannah, who I understand is to be 10 years old, is a very good singer. She's sung the national anthem at a couple of baseball games in Columbia, and his wife, Wendy, is here. So welcome to the studio. And Brad and I are going to, you know, back during, I guess, started in October, and then on in November, we had the Pinnacle Mountain Fire. And I wanted to do something with the South Carolina Forestry Commission about that fire, and because you'd be amazed the people that asked me all sorts of questions, and I didn't have all the answers. I had some. So I got a hold of Brad, and, of course, he was just busy as all get out, called me after it was all over and said, well, I guess you don't want me anymore. I said, no. This is afterwards is where we really need to explain everything that went on. So Brad's here, and I appreciate him being here.
Thank you for having me.
Got a few things to get out of the way. Wade Bourne died. And for those of you who don't watch Ducks Unlimited TV, listen to Wired to Fish Hunt Radio, you have missed out. Wade is a legend in the outdoor industry. He's been a full-time writer and television host for, 16 years? Probably more than that. He's a contributing editor, outdoor magazines. He's the editor-at-large for Ducks Unlimited, senior writer for Bassmaster Magazine, frequently in other. I met Wade in 2014 when he got the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Southeastern Outdoor Press Association. And he's really going to be missed. And it's amazing. Just dropped dead of a heart attack. You just never know when it's coming. But anyway, you ought to go on and read a little bit about Wade Bourne. If you haven't or don't know him already, you need to get to know him, even though he's gone now. Just an incredible guy. But we've got, for a calendar this week, we've only got one event, but we've got a live voice to help us with that event. We are talking to the younger Mike Abel from Hadrill's Point. Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing pretty good. How are things down at the coast these days?
It's been pretty nice. It's relatively warm for a December day. You know, it's like 75 degrees.
Oh, no. I don't know. Do you know who Reba Brinkman is, Mike?
I'm not sure that I do.
Okay, she was in charge of the Fly Fishing Expo up in North Carolina that happened every year, and she posted up, she's in Bozeman, Montana, it was like 40 below.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, you need to come back to North Carolina.
That's not my kind of weather.
It's not mine either. But, yeah, the coast is always nice. Any time of the year you can get down there. And you guys actually, for the second year in a row, are having the Shallow Water Expo. Tell us a little bit about last year, and then let's talk about this year's event.
Yeah, so last year was our first year doing it. My family owns Hadrill's Point and Tackle and Supply, and we're the ones who put it on. Previous years, somebody else had done it, but it had been about 10 or 15 years since the quote-unquote Shallow Water Expo was done. So last year, you know, I was kind of looking for something to really spruce up even the inshore fishing and even some business for us.
Sure.
In the off-season, and I think that really did it. You know, it was, I think for our first event, we just had an incredible turnout.
Yeah.
You know, last year we had several great celebrities come, like Rick Murphy.
Right.
From South Florida. Bob Clouser. You know, it's notorious for the Clouser Minnow Fly.
Yep.
And Mark Nichols, who owns DOA. And we had Linda Heller as well.
Right.
So we had, you know, as far as celebrities, we had a vast, vast group there. And it was, I thought it was a great turnout. It was well attended. But we put on seminars. Demonstrations, did some raffles, had all kinds of special pricing. And we're really going to do the same thing this year and just try to do it even bigger. But this year we've got C.A. Richardson, who is a little further north. You know, he's like in the Tampa area.
Okay.
And he has Flats Class TV. But we're also inviting Mark Nichols back, again, who is the owner of DOA.
Right.
Both of those guys just put on a terrific seminar. I mean, if nothing else, just come listen to these guys talk. I mean, it just, you know, if you're new into fishing or just trying to, you know, get better at your fishing artificial game, I mean, these guys are the guys to come listen to.
Yeah.
So highly, highly recommend it. But, you know, if nothing else, it's a great event to come just, you know, in the off season, something to come drink a cold beer, walk around and look at new boats for the year, and look at fishing tackle. I mean, I don't know what guy doesn't like to do this.
Well, and you said a word that just doesn't go with fishing. That's off season. Is there?
Yeah.
I don't think there's an off season with fishing.
You're exactly right.
Some of my friends up north are ice fishing right now. You know, I don't know if they're out there or not, but it's cold enough to be ice fishing.
Definitely.
But yeah, last year I had Bob Clouser on the show. We had a ball. It was just so fun to talk to. And did a little promo for the expo up here, that show. This year it's January 21st, 22nd. Is it back at the Omar Shrine Temple?
It is going to be back at the Omar Shrine Temple. Yeah.
When you say seminars and all, is there going to be a schedule published for that?
There is, and I'm actually, to be honest with you, I'm working on that to finish that up in the next couple of weeks, and I'll post that. You know, I'll post everything on our – we have a Facebook page. It's under 2017 Shallow Water Fishing Expo, so you can go on Facebook and look for that. You can also find it off of our Hatchell's Point Facebook page and our website, hatchellspoint.com. So there's several ways to look for it. You can also – go buy tickets. I mean, I've been telling a lot of people, really, if you're looking for a stocking stuffer, you know, the tickets are $5 and you can print out the ticket and put it in your son's stocking.
All right.
So there's several ways, but it's going to be back at Patriots Point, you know, the Omar Shrine Temple right on Patriots Point.
$5
to get in.
Yeah.
And it's Saturday 9 to 6 and Sunday is 9 to 3. So really looking forward to it, man. It's going to be another great event. So.
Yeah, I'm trying to think like last year. Let's see, you had Z-Man there. You had Flood Tide Company was there. I know you had a Hell's Bay boat, and I don't even want to go there. A beautiful Hell's Bay flats boat sitting out in the. And you had, of course, Hadrill's had a big display there. You had Penn there. It was really a neat thing to go to, especially if you're thinking about getting into saltwater fishing. You know, here in the upstate.
Well, not only can you come learn about it and learn how to use what we've got there, you know, you're hearing it from the guys, other guys who use it, not just the guys that you're buying it from at the shop.
Right.
You know, you're hearing it from the pro staffers and the guys that use it day in and day out. But on top of that, I mean, we got to run a lot of specials at the event, which was nice. I mean, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but like even last year, for example, we had one of the rod and reel combos is normally $300. We had it on sale for like $189.
Yeah.
You're basically getting a reel for free.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the market for things like that, it's a great way. Z-Man did a little special, you know, it was like a buy three, get one free kind of deal. There's lots of savings involved, but also to come look at the new product for 2017, including boats. I mean, you know, we're going to have Maverick. Maverick will be back. You know, I'm sure they'll have a Hughes or Pathfinder and Hell's Bay and East Cape, a lot of those guys, and a lot of big-name brands in the industry, like you said, Penn and Shimano. And we've got some new guys this year. We actually, you know, although it's called the Shallow Water Fishing Expo, we're really looking to kind of slowly move into more of the offshore side of it as well. So, like, this year we have Fathom Offshore coming, Steve Martin with Fish Razor. You know, he builds a lot of dredges and things like that. And so we've got some of those companies. So we're going to start to kind of dabble into a lot of the guys last year with Penn and Shimano, all your reel and rod companies. We just had inshore stuff.
Right.
But this year we're going to have some offshore stuff as well for those guys.
I mean, some of those names you're bringing in now are some people that I see down at ICAST every year. So that's getting pretty big.
It is. It does. Yeah. It does entail a lot of those guys. I mean, your St. Croix, Penn, Shimano. We have some Akuma guys there, all your Calcutta and Sea Striker. Star Rides. But we also have a lot of, you know, smaller local guys like Daniel Miner. He owns Miner Metal. And I don't know if you remember it from last year, but he just does a fantastic job with his machines and his workshop. I mean, he does, we sell his trailer hitches here, but okay. they're amazing. So it's definitely, you know, you can come find stuff like that. And you can also, we've got one of the dog rescues will be back this
okay.
year.
I remember them.
Yeah, walking around with the puppies, cute puppies.
So for those of you guys out there going to just leave your 10-year-old daughters at home because they have fits over puppies.
Yeah, like I told that to a little girl this morning at the shop, and her dad kind of looked at me like, thanks, you know, when I mentioned there'd be puppies at the fishing expo.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't really care for that too much.
Well, great. So. Well, again, that's January 21st, 22nd. Omar Shrine Temple there. Then just as you come off the bridge into Mount Pea, it's back to the right like you went to Patriots Point. And Hadrus Point's putting it on. Are you going to involve CCA this year like you did last year?
CCA is always going to be involved. Good. Yeah, to be honest, that's part of the reason why I wanted to do the event. CCA is one of my main organizations. So what they're going to do this year, what we've decided to do is have a sportsman raffle for one lucky winner. They're going to have to buy the raffle ticket from CCA at the booth there, but it's going to be a package worth $5,000.
Cool.
So they're going to get anything from like an inshore fishing trip, a bird hunt, you know, rods, reels, a bunch of gear. So one lucky winner is going to walk away with $5,000 worth of stuff.
That's worth the trip to Charleston.
I would say so.
That's good. Well, Mike, I appreciate you coming on to the show today. A shop number in case anybody wants to call for more information.
Yeah, you can always call us 843-881-3644. And like I said, you can always check our Facebook or HadrusPoint.com. Our website has all our info as well.
Very cool. Thanks for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you soon, Mike.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Sir. Bye-bye. Let's take a break. Be back with more Woods and Water South Carolina on the other side. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. I hope you'll make plans to get down to Charleston. It was a fun time. Anytime you can go to Charleston, spend the night, whether it's family or just a bunch of guys and all, it's a great place to be. And what better way to spend some time in Charleston than looking at new fishing stuff? And, you know, if you worked it right, you could probably go fishing while you were down there. We're glad to have Brad Brown in the studio, South Carolina Forestry Commission. Brad, take just a minute. I know you've got several CFBI, you know, the acronyms after your name. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do at the Forestry Commission.
Okay. Yeah. First of all, I'd like to thank you for having me here. Been with the Forestry Commission 25 years. I'm a registered forester here in South Carolina and a certified forester nationally. I work in our Columbia office and our state office over on Broad River Road beside, Harbison State Forest. And I'm on our fire staff, and primarily I work with fire departments doing federal access equipment for them to get equipment that they can use for wildland firefighting, and also do wildland grants for them to get grants for them to help their wildland firefighting as well.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about it. Certified forester. There's a couple other titles you have after your name. Is that a degree you go get? A certification you get after being in the industry?
It is.
How do you do that?
Yeah, I do. I have a 4-year degree from Clemson University, a Bachelor of Science in Forest Management.
Okay.
So, after I've graduated from Clemson, I actually started off working directly with the Forestry Commission. So here in the state of South Carolina, if you graduate from a 4-year school with a Bachelor of Science in Forestry, Forest Management, you have to take a registered forester's exam.
Okay.
It's kind of like nursing or lawyers have to take engineering.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you successfully pass the exam and have 2 years of experience, you become a registered forester.
Okay. Okay.
Now we have to take continuing education like a lot of those other, just like nursing, the other ones have to do too. So we have to take at least 10 credit educations of hours every year to keep that certification up.
Very nice. Well, when I first got a hold of you, we weren't in the middle of the Pinnacle Mountain Fire. I think we were kind of towards the end, but kind of the time when it was just, you know which way it was going to go. We were That's looking right. for rain. It was so mm-hmm. hot, and I knew you guys were busy. And I said, just when you get a chance, get back to me. Last week, you were going through some old emails, found me, called right. me. And I said, you know what? I said, it may be over, but there's a lot of questions that a lot of people ask me, you know, wow, the trees, the woods are just burning up there. And, you know, what's it going to be like? There's not going to be anything left. And I said, you know, this is still a good time to educate people about exactly what happened with Pinnacle Mountain.
Right.
So start us off. How did Pinnacle Mountain fire start? And it just grew because we didn't have any rain.
It did. that part of the state was our driest part of the state. Going back all the way through the summer, even when Hurricane Matthew came through.
Sure.
If you remember, the coast obviously was flooded, even up into the Midlands. I live in the Midlands area, and we got a fair amount of rain. But the very northwestern corner of the state just did not get much
right.
rain. So we knew that part of the state was very dry. November the 9th, there's some people, from best we can tell, were camping up there.
Okay.
They had a camp ring. With the dry conditions already, the forest fuels were very dry. It didn't take much of a spark for it to get out.
Right.
We thought we had it contained. I think under a normal year, we probably could have had it contained at a very much smaller level. But with the winds getting the way they were, right. we just could not stop.
Yeah. It was, you're right. The upstate and that area was under extreme drought over the summer and all. And the coast was flooded.
Right.
And, boy, I tell you, if you get some moderation between the two, we'd all been a lot better right. off. Start to finish, how long did that fire burn?
About? It burned.
I mean, is it out now?
It is. We have 100% contained it.
Okay.
Until we actually started getting those heavy rains there at the very end, we were still monitoring it very closely. We still have teams out there now that are periodically checking on it.
Okay.
One interesting thing that we were able to do was we had the National Guard Blackhawks.
Right.
We had Chinooks.
Right.
And we had some smaller helicopters up there that have infrared cameras on them.
Okay.
So we were able to fly the perimeter of the fire, pick up the heat signatures, and that's what we would use to take back and put into a mapping program
okay.
to find out our exact acreage.
Okay.
So we could find out a very good, precise acreage, and we could also find out where the hot spots were
right.
on fire. And that's kind of where we would know to allocate a lot of our forces there.
Well, and I wondered that because you could ride. I mean, one weekend we were up on Bald Rock, and you could look mm-hmm. just back to the right and see the fire on both sides, I guess, behind
right.
Table Rock. And then another time I actually did drive down 11 after it was, I think the fire was pretty much on the backside by that time, later in the fire.
Yes.
And you could see the Blackhawks and the Chinooks mm-hmm. running around and dumping. And I wondered, well, now, how do they know where to dump that at? Is there somebody on the ground telling them where? Or
We do. We have. Okay. Basically, we use this thing called ICS, Instant Command System.
Okay.
It's been around for years. The military uses it. It's way to break things up to be very organized because a lot of our fires here in South Carolina, most of them are average 5 to 6 acres.
Okay.
We have a lot of we probably have more number of fires this side of the Mississippi than in the West Coast.
Okay.
They have these huge fires.
Right.
But we have a lot more of them, but they're smaller. So
right.
when we get something this large, we have a lot of people here. So you got to have some kind of system to manage
sure.
it.
Sure.
So we break them up into crews. Usually it's a 20-person crew with a crew boss, maybe an assistant crew boss, and they're broken into squads of six.
Okay.
So they're out there. It's very remote, very steep. We take bulldozers in there, and we try to put in dozer lines in where we can. But
right.
when it gets so steep, they have to go in there with tools and basically put them in by hand. So we've got guys out there and ladies with walkie-talkies,
okay.
and they're able to communicate back up with the Chinooks and
gotcha.
The Blackhawks, and they'll say, you know, come over here, and a lot of times we'll use basically the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11,
sure.
12 on
like
the
on
clock.
Compass. Like on a clock.
So
okay.
say, come to your, drop your water at your 12 o'clock or at your 10 o'clock, and it's this hot spot.
Okay.
So we had good communications. We knew where to drop the water, and that was very effective. We were able to knock it down and keep it contained. but that itself wasn't enough.
Right.
The fire was, the ground was so dry. We had such low humidities and the winds were such that we had to actually, in several occasions, we had to back up to where we could really put in a really good line and set a backfire and let that fire back into the head fire. So by the time the head fire came in, it hit an area where the fuel was already burned up
right.
And it would go out.
Yeah. And that's one thing I want to get to in a little bit is back burns and all that you were setting. The helicopters, those National Guard helicopters helping you guys out?
They were.
Okay.
Yes.
But you obviously had forestry people on board to help them.
We did.
Okay. I gotcha.
We did. We've got a relationship with the South Carolina National Guard where okay. It's a partnership with them. And, so that was a very tremendous help using them up there.
How many people total involved on the ground up there, do you think?
At one time, the most we had was close to 300, which is like I said, most fires, we may have just a few people.
Sure.
So that was a tremendous task for us to be able to handle something of that size.
And how many, and of those 300 people, were most of them South Carolinians? I mean, I know you had some firefighters come in from out of state.
We did. Most of them were. We had a lot of volunteer firefighters that would come in and help. They would come in up under one of our guys
okay.
and be. But we would have these specialized, those 20-person teams mm-hmm. I'm telling you about.
Right.
We had some of those that came from out west, and that's all they do.
Yeah.
And so they specialized, and they really did a great job. We probably had 60 or 70 of those out there at one
wow.
time.
I knew we got a lot of attention when you start drawing in crews from out west and all, and you're right. Those guys, it's a full-time job for them.
Mm-hmm.
How many acres was it total? And we got just a little bit here before we got a break.
The total acres was 10,623 acres.
That's a big fire. What,
that's
comparison. Do we have any? We don't have those often.
We don't. That's our third largest fire ever in the state. It's our most expensive fire as far as the cost to fight the fire ever.
Unreal. Wow. Well, let's hang on. We got more we're going to talk about, not just about the Pinnacle Mountain Fire, but the Forestry Commission. Benefits of fire. It's, you know, I hate to refer to it as onions, but you peel off layers, there's more stuff. So hang on through the break. We'll be back with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. We're here with Brad Bramlett from the South Carolina Forestry Commission talking about Pinnacle Mountain Fire. I know I got a lot of questions about it, and I didn't have all the answers, so I figured I'd reach out and find somebody that does. He's good enough to come in and sit in the studio with me today in connection with the Pinnacle Mountain Fire. And Pinnacle Mountain, you know, they say that, and people go, where's that? Well, it's essentially a round Table Rock, but tell us where, in really, everybody knows where the bald face of Table Rock Mountain is.
Right.
Where was this fire in relation to that?
Okay, basically, if you're standing looking at Table Rock, just to your left.
Okay.
So it's basically west. When the fire started on the top of Pinnacle Mountain, as it started running, it was basically running northeast.
Okay.
We hoped that we were going to be able to stop it in what they call Panther Gap right before it got to the rock.
Okay.
But it was so steep we couldn't. So we had a contingency plan where we ended up having to use what we did to tie right. it all the way off over to the reservoir
okay.
and actually burn all the way around the woods there at Table Rock.
When we talk about this fire, question I got a lot, what kind of fire was it? You know, I had people say, oh, the woods are burning up, there's not going to be anything. What kind of fire was this?
This was, again, it's a little bit different than our typical fire. Most of our fires are very just small, creeping.
Okay.
This fire did move with the intensity. There will be some trees that will die, but I think you will see a lot of undergrowth that will be cleared out.
Okay.
And it's the trees, most of the trees probably going to be fine up there.
Okay. Because in the press releases I was getting, it was saying it was a litter fire.
Oh, you're talking about as far as the
yeah.
origin?
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, best we can tell,
litter, like the
underneath. Oh, okay. Yes.
Like a litter. Not that in paper and all
right,
that.
Right, I understand.
The branches,
right.
pine needles,
yes,
leaves,
did.
Stuff like that.
It did not get into what we call a crown fire.
Okay.
So it didn't get up into the tops of the trees where it was really just crowning out. We did get some height and
okay.
get some stuff, what we call torching, where you get some trees that would just kind of flare up really
okay.
quick.
Okay.
But a lot of it was just stayed fairly low to the ground. It would get up some and run a little bit, but it wasn't really tremendous.
Because what people see on TV with California, you see those trees just exploding
right.
at the crown.
Right.
How hot does it have to get up there to get a tree to do that?
Well, and again, what we were burning in over here was mostly hardwoods.
Right.
We're out west, and a lot of those are conifers.
Okay.
And that sap content is going to make it burn a lot hotter.
Okay.
Yeah, so these hardwoods, while they will burn and the hardwood leaves will burn, it doesn't burn near as hot as it does out west.
Okay. And we talk about some of the trees and the litter, but fire is a great thing. And we might have to come back and talk about this, but fire, yes, it's... While it's going on, you're having to fight it and you're worried about structures and stuff like that. Yeah, it is a bad thing.
Right.
But once it's over and done, boy, the benefits to wildlife
and
new growth and all is going to be evident there this spring. And we might have to get back to that. You mentioned something last segment, backburns.
Yes.
Explain to us what a backburn is. And especially in like you were saying, you were hoping to contain it in the gap, but you couldn't get a good enough line there to stop it, so you had to drop back to the next, I guess, defensible position, if you want to look at it that way. But tell us about that.
So again, these areas are so steep, they're in there, basically imagine in the woods raking a fire break.
Okay.
So it's only just a few feet wide, and you're trying to stop this wildfire coming through there. It kept jumping those areas, so we would have to back up to where we could get a really good wider line in.
Okay.
So we're setting a backfire that slowly burns into the wind. It's not burning as intense. And basically what it's doing is consuming all that fuel out in front of the head fire. So it might burn 50, 100, 200, 300 feet out in front.
Okay.
And so by the time that head fire gets there, there's no fuel. So if you think of the fire triangle, fuel, heat, and oxygen.
Okay.
You got to have all three of those things. So we're removing the fuel part of that fire triangle.
Right.
So when that head fire gets there, it's either going to burn very slow or go out.
Okay. The wind really did a number on us up there. And it did a number on us up, and it even more in Gatlinburg. That was just incredible what happened up there overnight.
It did.
But it was dry and you had the wind. And how hard is it to deal with the wind in a fire like this?
Wind is the main factor that drives wildfires.
Okay.
It's the number one thing that we have to deal with. Can be the most destructive, and a lot of times it can be the most variable because it can be going one direction and you're fighting, all of a sudden it shifts, then you got a whole different head fire. So, whereas topography, if you got fire running up a slope, it's not going to change. So you know what it's doing.
Okay.
So wind can be very variable and it can be difficult to work with.
And as dry as it was, a couple embers here, that's why you had to jump in the fire line.
That's right. Yes, and you think about over here, again, out west, the reason their fires can be most of the time so bad is their humidities are much lower out there.
Right.
During this time, we actually had humidities in the teens, which is very similar to what's out west.
Right.
Most of the time, we don't get that.
We don't. And normally, you know, even in the summertime, it's 60-70%, which is normal humidity for here.
That's right.
But we were having humidity levels in the 20s and 30s fire was going on.
That's right.
How big a... Talking about humidity and how it affects a fire, humidity keeps a fire from growing. How?
Well, for one thing, once you start getting humidities up 30, 40, 50%, if you get an ember that is picked up by the fire, if it drops off in an unburned area, it may just extinguish and go out and not burn anything. But if it's really dry and the ember drops in dry leaves, it's going to take off and start another fire.
It's just
fire.
As dry and hot when it hits as it is when it leaves. But when you have a fires like your campfires, you notice the ember's going up, and with humidity levels and normal, by the time it gets 15, 20 feet, it's gone.
That's right. But when it's dry like this is, if you get a big enough ember, we've seen studies where it can pick embers up and move them a half a mile or a mile. The Myrtle Beach fire that we had in 2009, most of those houses that were burned and destroyed were from embers picking up and going several hundred yards to a half a mile, landing in pine straw, catching the side of the house on fire that way. Not from the actual flame, but from embers.
Okay. 2009, was that one of the other big fires we had?
That was our largest fire, the Myrtle Beach, the Highway 31 fire there in Myrtle Beach, yes.
How many acres was it?
That was a little over 20,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Explain containment. A lot of people, you know, fire officials have it 30% contained, but yet it's still growing and all that. How do you get a containment percentage that you would put out a news press release?
Okay. Again, when we, it helps very beneficial this year when we had that helicopter and that infrared flight.
Okay.
So we could see those hot spots at night. And when we figure out what that flame impingement is on the edge of the fire break, the incident commander who's over the entire fire, he gets with his operations chief and they decide how comfortable do they feel with the percentage of the fire break that they feel is going to hold.
Okay.
So if the back portion of it, that's sort of cool and it's the very, the furthest part from where the fire has already gone.
Okay.
That's usually your coolest spot. And okay, they're going to say, well, that's already cool. We don't have to focus on that.
Okay.
The head fire, where the fire is going, yes. So you might start off, it's only 5% contained.
Okay.
Well, that means pretty much the entire perimeter, you got fire that's active and at any one point in time can get out. And even though you might even have a line around it,
okay,
it's still active and it could very easily jump your line.
Okay.
It's once you get a line around it and you feel safe that that line's not going to spread anymore, and you don't have anything to where it can get out, is where we start talking about containment.
And that containment number is dependent really on that fire and the fire lines you've got between it and what it's where it's headed.
That's right. And that, again, we had a good line around it there at the very end. The rains that we had that came in and put some really significant amounts, you know, 3-4 inches, 5 inches of rain getting deep down into those, to that, all that lift, leader,
right.
Those leaves, pine needles and stuff, that was a tremendous help. Yes.
So we didn't burn up like everybody thinks we did. It's pretty much out now. Do we have any erosion? Are we going to have any issues with erosion up there, you think?
Best we think, we're not. We're going in, we're working with the Park Service where the trails are. We're going in, we've helped them, putting in like washouts so the trails don't erode out.
Okay.
Where we had to cross the streams, we're going in and taking excavators and clearing that out. So we're looking at water quality.
Okay.
We're doing everything we can. Some of the roads we're going in and seeding and putting in some plants like wheat or something,
right,
to help hold the ground down, and it'll be beneficial for wildlife as well.
Sure.
So we want to try to do everything that we can to lessen any kind of impacts for that. So anything that we can do, we're wanting to try to do to make sure that there's no any kind of impact from erosion.
Okay.
We're going to be monitoring it. We're working with the Park Service. We've got what we call our best management practices foresters that they work with loggers a lot of times on,
okay,
logging sites. And so they are going to go out there and they're going to look. Incidentally, we've been working with the Greenville Watershed there. Hydrologists and other, they've gone out there and they've tested the water,
okay,
at the watershed, and they have not seen any impact,
okay,
at
good,
the water. So we feel good about where we are right now. We're going to continue to monitor it. And right now we think everything's going well.
And I mean, we're going to have to come back. We're going to be done with this segment in a minute or so. You and I were talking and you prescribed burning, and burning in itself is not a bad thing. And come springtime, I mean, you're going to have a proliferation of wildflowers up there, you think?
I think you will. You'll have a lot of new growth. It does. In fact, a lot of times you'll have seeds that were in that litter layer that you were talking about earlier,
right,
that were just laying there. And if they get down to that ground,
contact,
they'll be able to germinate and start growing. Yes.
A lot of information there. I hope you were listening. Brad, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having
me. Let's do this again because we got a lot of other things we can get in. Wendy, thanks for coming in. Savannah, thank you for being here. Y'all have a safe trip back to Columbia. You and I will touch base and we'll get you back on, or somebody else, because
yeah,
there's a lot more here to discuss.
Love to. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, hang on through the break. I haven't forgotten about Christmas. We got a couple of fishing trips to give away, so we'll be back with more Woods and Water South Carolina. To Woods and Water South Carolina. If you missed something during that segment with Brad, I'm going to take that. It'll be up on the website, the podcast. I'll put it on the Facebook page as a podcast link. A lot of information there. I hope it cleared up some of what you might have wondered about the Pinnacle Mountain Fire. Third largest in the state, over 10,000 acres. And what did he say? I forget how many people were up there, but a bunch of them. it was quite a shock to see that here in South Carolina. You used to seeing that from those Western states sometimes, but you just don't expect that in South Carolina, which is, but you know, it's not like the woods are burned up. You will have greenery up there come springtime.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas.
And that means it's Christmas here in Woods and Water, South Carolina. I have a saltwater fishing trip out of Charleston, South Carolina for four people. It's a four-hour trip through Holy City Fishing Charters. Caller number 1-877-235-9405, and it's yours. 877-235-9405. Holy City Fishing Charters, up to four people. You have redfish, trout. If you want to go shark fishing, John will take you shark fishing. John is a great guy. Good friend of this show, a good friend to me, and always tells me, hey, look, I'm interested in getting people outdoors or out on the water. So go fishing, put that in somebody's stocking. That'll really make their day. I have an article here that just absolutely blew my mind when I read it, but, it was Sporting Classics Daily, which is a great site. If you don't get Sporting Classics Daily, it's an email. You need to go sign up, sportingclassicsdaily.com. You can sign up. I don't think they share. I haven't seen that they've shared anything. I think they keep it pretty close to their vest. But, the title of the article is Who's Afraid of the Great Outdoors? And it sent shivers down my spine when I read this. And when I read it, you'll understand why. In one of his recent op-ed, and this is by Doug Painter, Tuesday, December 6th, 2016, are today's children and adults too afraid to go outside and enjoy nature? And I'm just going to read this because you can't paraphrase this at all. In one of his recent op-ed columns in the New York Times, Thomas Friedman noted that Robert McFarlane in 2015 book Landmarks made the point that a recent edition of the Oxford Junior Dictionary, which is aimed at seven-year-olds, no longer includes words such as fern, otter, dandelion, pasture, and willow. It's not that these words have somehow acquired improper or politically incorrect connotations. Not at all. Instead, as McFarlane reveals, the editors of the dictionary deemed that such nature words, and that's in quotations, were simply less relevant to the lives of modern children. So what phrase or terms took their place? How about broadband, blog, cut and paste, MP3 player, and voicemail? I suppose you could call this an example of editorial Darwinism, a system where only the fittest of the vocabulary survive. In books, as in nature, I guess there's room for only so much to make the cut. Remember when Mom used to tell us, now go outside and play? Sure, she wanted us out from underfoot, but she also knew that's exactly where we wanted to be. Outdoors is where we could build a fort, dam up a creek, skip rocks across a pond. It was fun, but we learned that moss-covered rocks in a stream are slippery as all get out, and shiny three-leaved plants can give you an awful itch. As we got older, we came to understand the care and responsibility in carrying a rifle in the field, of knowing both the written and unwritten rules of the hunt, and how to determine when to take or not take a shot. And over time, we came to appreciate the value of an honest effort in the field, even when we came home empty-handed. Nature is a great teacher, and I feel sorry for youngsters who were never given the opportunity to hunt or fish, or for that matter, to strap on a backpack or canoe down a river for a few days. A recent column by James Campbell of the Los Angeles Times is a stark reminder of how little time many of today's kids, and indeed many of today's adults, spend outdoors. As a boy, Campbell writes, I wandered the woods and fields unsupervised from morning until dark. Today, many children spend less than 30 minutes per week playing outside, and as many as 7 hours a day glued to TV screens, iPads, and video games. Their parents are no better. Adults spend 93% of their lives inside buildings or vehicles. Researchers, Campbell points out, say a growing number of Americans suffer from biophobia, a fear of the natural world. Really? A fear of the natural world? In children especially, a mere flock of birds or a strong wind can provoke surges of anxiety, triggering the same fight or flight response that evolved to protect us from deadly threats. Not surprisingly, Campbell reaffirms that evidence suggesting that time spent outdoors boosts kids' self-esteem, problem-solving skills, cooperation, focus, and self-discipline. There's another threat to our future, and that's CWD. In a number of states across America, beginning with the winter 2016 issue, the Boone and Crockett Club's Fair Chase magazine is kicking off an ongoing and in-depth look at this deadly disease. Scientists at the University of Wyoming, for example, studied deer in the southeastern part of the state from 2003 to 10, asking the question, could CWD alone account for the decline of an entire free-ranging deer population? The researchers found that CWD, where present, led to a 10% decrease in a herd size per year, which could cause extinction in certain areas within 50 years. That's a scary and sobering thought, but here's another one. In 50 years, will many of today's 7-year-olds care? It's up to us to help them understand why they should. Did you get that? Words like fern, otter, willow, pasture, dandelion. Not in the kids' dictionary anymore because they've been replaced with words like broadband, blog, cut and paste, MP3, or voicemail. It's unreal. Unreal. I've got so many articles about how much time kids spend in technology. And I know it's a seductive babysitter. I mean, you buy a video game and they disappear for 2 hours and it's like, wow, I get something done, or I can, you know, answer emails, or I can spend a little time with the TV myself. And that's a, that's a slippery road, my friend. Parents, grandparents, guardians, foster parents, whatever. And if those kids are not getting outside today and don't get that exposure as growing up, they won't care about things that we care about today when they get our age. There's no experience there to make them care. I have an article here that's New Year's resolutions for the outdoorsman. One of the things is to take someone else, make someone else an outdoorsman. Challenge you to do that in 2017.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas.
If you are a fly fisherman, this is a fly fishing trip only. I have a charter from Low Country Fly Shop in Charleston, South Carolina for redfish, or you can probably find some trout out there, but it's a fly fishing charter. 877-235-9405, caller number 1, 877-235-9405. Dave, this has to be for fly fishermen only. It's for up to 2 people. They have a great new boat coming. It's an Evo skiff. Sweet skiff. Shallow water. I mean, poling ease. East Cape skiffs did it. So if you're a fly fisherman, you want to go fly fishing in Charleston, here you go. And that's Christmas on Woods and Water, South Carolina. I got some other stuff, but I may save that until after Christmas. That's what I may do. I may, if you didn't get something for Christmas, I may have a little something here for you afterwards. But I'd love for you to think about that article I just read. I mean, is that not, you know, replacing words from nature with words from technology in a dictionary for 7-year-olds? I just don't get it. You know, I understand it's, you can't kick your kids out the door, but when you want to, go with them. Richard Louv's book, and I've quoted these passages a lot over the years that I've done this show. You know, be excited yourself. Make it a learning experience. You know, go with your kid. Make it fun for both of you. And it doesn't have anything great. You know, my kids come, Jordan came home from school. Jordan, what you want to do outside? Well, let's go sit in the deer stand. So we went and sat in the deer stand one day for a few hours. We could have cared less about shooting a deer. We talked. Sometimes we whispered. Not all the time. But it was about spending time together. You know, what else did she want to do? She wanted the mountains and hikes. We went up and hiked to some waterfalls. You know, took us maybe 3 hours. It doesn't take a huge investment of either money or time to get kids outside. But what it does take is the willingness to do it. And like this, I'm trying to find this one. Some of these, Keep your dog in shape. Yeah, I need to get in shape more than my dog, I think. Gosh, can't find it now. Learn to survive. Rediscover the basics. Well, that would be a good one. The Sand County Almanac. If you're looking for a stocking stuffer or a book for someone, Sand County Almanac would be a great book. That's, you know, Aldo Leopold's book. Oh, let's see. Where is that one? Is this it? Here we go. It's number 20. Introduce someone new to hunting and fishing. The number of outdoorsmen has been declining over the last few years, and one of the main reasons many people don't participate in outdoor sports is because there is no one to teach them how to get started. Remember all the people who helped you get started hunting and fishing? I do. Now it's time to pass it on to the next generation. Because look, when there are no more hunters and fishermen paying the excise taxes to keep up all the national parks and wildlife agencies and fund a lot of these studies and research, who's going to do it? Who's going to pick up the tab that we're paying? And that's the next generation. Oh, well, it's Christmas. I won't be here for the next 2 weeks. Nobody will be. Dave's going to take a couple weeks off. Whole radio station's going to be shut down for over the Christmas weekend, over the New Year's weekend. Pulled together some best stuff for the year. Some of the guests that I've had that have really been good ones, big names, good topics. And so I guess the next time I talk to you live will be 2017. Hope you have a Merry Christmas. Hope you have a Happy New Year. Find some time to get out there. There's nothing like being in the outdoors, people. I'm telling you. When you get time to get out there, take those back roads. A lot more to see on there than on I-26. And as always, don't forget that camera. I'll see you in 2017.